now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. And that's something that I sincerely believe, that we all come into this world with the very best parts of ourselves, the very best of who we are. And oftentimes we don't realize that, and so we need to go in and find it. But that often takes courage, because through all that, we have to work through other issues that might challenge our faith or really shake us to, you know, our core. But those things can be unlearned. A lot of things can be relearned or retaught, and certainly forgiveness and letting go in order to take hold of something better. Those things are all possible. So very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And as I mentioned, each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And I place all this all within the context of relationships, relationships with ourselves, relationships with each other, and our relationship with God or the divine. And the reason why I place this integration or this emphasis on relationships, because whenever you think about it, how often do we receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds, all within the context of relationships? However, and here's the irony, we can also receive our greatest healing and our strength and our peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. Because whenever we are transformed and we are being transformed, we also transform others by our presence, our grace and understanding. And as always, the transformation must begin with us. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's shows or other shows, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, and that's all one word. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And just in case you may not be able to spend the whole hour with me today, I invite you to go back in through the archives, because these broadcasts are podcasted, and invite you, like I said, go back in and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. Now, for those of you new to the program, I'd just like to say welcome. I always enjoy new listeners, and just ask that you would shoot me a line and what you think of the program so far. And I would just like to reiterate that, again, I am a firm believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need for this life. And this is something that I enjoy sharing with others because, I firmly believe this. And a lot of times, probably my greatest joy in sharing this information comes from just sharing it with teenagers or kids. Because how often are kids blamed for the problems within their families? And when I get them, whenever I sit down with them and counsel them, you know, right away they're, you know, just fully engrossed in, well, it's my fault. I'm so riddled with shame. I feel so guilty. If only I could be a better student, or if I can only be a better son or a better daughter. And right away, you know, I correct this stinking thinking, as I put it to them. Usually I get a laugh out of them when I say that. But this is a misperception that's often portrayed out there by society. You know, let's blame the child, or let's blame the adolescent for doing nothing but acting out of as to what they are experiencing or not experiencing in the family, and how often children or others are blamed and made out to be the scapegoats. But I quickly tell them that you are not the one at blame here. You're the one that's reacting to everything. And of course, that perks up their ears, and I got their full attention at that part. At that point, I'm sorry. And just want to hear more. And usually as I get to hear their stories and so forth, sooner or later, it doesn't matter, but sooner or later, they're going to say things like, why do I have to deal with this stuff? Why couldn't my parents deal with this? Or how come my grandparents couldn't deal with it? And that gives me an opportunity to share with something that I don't think they've ever heard before. And that is, have you ever stopped to consider that you are not the problem, but you're the solution to all this? In other words, you are the strongest person in your family to be able to heal yourself, from all this stuff, but also, offer the healing to others, especially those who have come before you and those who will come after you, even, those who have yet to be born, which they can't even imagine yet. But it is something that when they find healing, they stop that cycle of abuse, or they stop that cycle of addiction, or they stop something maladaptive that's been affecting them. And usually when I share that with the kids, they get a great big smile, and they get a little empowerment, and they sit up straight, and they're like, wow, I never realized that before. You're saying that I'm actually the strongest one in the family to be able to do this? And yep, that's exactly what I am saying. And you can just see the empowerment on their faces, and they're like, okay, well, just tell me what to do. Let's go. And it's like, okay, slow down, kid, slow down. But they are less intimidated to look at these issues, because they really want to see the family issues, and however far back they go, they really want to see these family issues for what they are, and how their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, or however far back they want to go, how they often struggled with it. And I often tell them, it's like, look, we're going to do this kind of work, but we're not going to start pointing fingers, because, we didn't live back then, and we didn't, perhaps realize everything that they've gone through, and maybe they had to do things that they didn't want to do for the sake of whatever, or they just weren't strong enough to stop whatever was coming down, to them, how they were parented and so forth. But it's all through the intention of wanting to reach out and to heal them as well as healing themselves. So at any rate, sooner or later, the kid, I keep saying kid because I'm certainly old enough to be their grandparent, but, the client in general, and just put it that way, or people I talk to, often they don't realize their giftedness. And they often go through life functioning from that place of woundedness, or they want to fall back into victimization and just convince themselves like that's all they're ever going to be. Or, you can't expect too much from me because, or I've been told on more than one occasion that I will never amount to anything, so therefore I cannot, or whatever voice, that people have grown up with telling them that based on another person's perception and opinions, there's not much to them. But that is just plain wrong. Everybody, and I mean everybody, has this uniqueness to them, this hachetas. And it is a place that, you need to go find. And what is keeping the very best things in you and about you from coming out? It could be anxiety, depression, it could be anything like that, but it's often much, much deeper, unhealed wounds or unresolved trauma or just interpersonal problems where there needs to be forgiveness and understanding and letting go of those things that are so burdensome to the soul and take on something better. That is your entire self, the core of who you are. So at any rate, when we're able to do this, we don't go through life functioning, as I said, from that place of woundedness or victimization. But instead, in all of our relationships, we can function from a place of healing, wholeness, and embracing that hachetas, or that uniqueness. And certainly understanding that there is so much more to us than what we have become so far. And as I said, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. Finding the courage to reclaim that which has always, and I mean always, been in you. Well, how is your heart today? I start off every broadcast with that question. You know, how is your heart today? I hope it is well. I hope you are well. And I also pray that if you are struggling today, that you'll be able to find rest and comfort and the peace that you need. And certainly self-care is a must. Well, I wanted to wish everybody out there Gong Hoi Fat Chow, or Happy Chinese New Year. The new lunar year is here at the stroke of midnight, not today, but last night. Welcome to the Year of the Ox. Now, just reading up on a little bit of like, what can we expect from this Year of the Ox? And just some interesting things, because according to the Chinese astrology, 2021 is going to be a very lucky year, as well as it's also a perfect year for us to focus on relationships, and whether we're talking about friendships or love or amour. So in the Chinese zodiac, the ox itself is very hardworking, very methodical. So 2021 is going to be a year of many blessings, but also it's going to be also a year of hard work that will be rewarded. And those with this zodiac sign who are lucky in terms of money this year, they will be the ones that make a considerable effort. So, in other words, this is going to be a year when we will fully feel the weight of our responsibilities, and a year when it is necessary to double our efforts to accomplish anything at all. So, hard work, okay? Do not shy away from it in whatever you do. Okay, in whatever you do, work hard and keep a proper focus. Keep a greater context in mind that the work that we do, it's not just about ourselves, but it impacts others. And we say, you know, all over the world in some shape or some form. Well, the times that I was in India, it was amazing to me that the cow and or the ox was considered the most revered of all the animals, because of what the cow provides for the people in terms of milk and butter and cheese, okay? And this is one of the reasons, as it was explained to me, that the Hindi people are vegetarians, because they do not kill, but they do revere the cow, because the cow freely gives the milk, and then you take it and you turn it into butter and cheese and so forth. So this belief goes all the way back to the days of Krishna, which he lived somewhere around like 3200 BC, 3200 BC, somewhere around there. And he was born in Mathura, which is located about 90 miles southeast of Delhi. And it takes a couple of hours to get there and so forth. And Vrindavan, it's a city within Mathura where Krishna spent his childhood and learning the ways of being a cowherdsman. So he grew up with cows and the milkmaids, and, you know, it was just something that he valued greatly. But, you know, it wasn't until I read the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata that I started to understand the perspective of the Hindi people. And this is what I mean. You know, through the eyes of Krishna and his cousin Arjuna, those ethical and moral dilemmas of human life, in other words, the questions about human freedom and choices and responsibilities towards yourself and towards others, are clearly taught. And I've read those books a couple of times now, and I really enjoy. You can download these on Audible as you want. One of the things I love to do is I have the book and then I download it on Audible, because I got all these extra credits for some reason, and I just follow along with the narration. and just how that allows me to retain the material much better. It's just, I really, really enjoy that. So if you have never read the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata is quite lengthy. So you'll have to pace yourself, but it is just a great read because, again, it places all these spiritual teachings, these spiritual understandings in the place, in the greater context of relationships. Okay. And also, when I was in India, not only being aware of cows and oxen and things like that, and also reading the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, but I also spent much time talking with gurus and teachers about matters of faith or spirituality or the breath of God and the Kundalini energy and sitting in silence and inner peace. And this was something that was just definitely life-changing for me, especially sitting in silence. I mean, how many of us, when it comes to prayer, are we just yakking away? And we're just like, okay, God, here's my laundry list of things I would like you to do today for me, or so forth. Or this is what I need you to do for this other person or something like that. And I thought I knew all about sitting in silence, you know, as a meditative form, but they're like, uh-uh. You know, they took me into silence and don't know much of that about what happened after that because I just kind of woke up, you know, many minutes later and realized that they had taken me on a spiritual journey. And the silence of just listening for God in the silence, or what we would call silence, was phenomenal. And so I came away with just a greater appreciation for sitting in silence and listening to that inner peace. And so we talked about many of these matters. And because they know I'm a Christian, we also talked about Jesus. And one of the more interesting teachings that they shared with me when I was with them was when we talked about the time between, you know, Jesus, his age between, let's say, age 12 through 29. And, typically in our Bibles, there is nothing mentioned about this time. You know, it's often referred to as the silent years of Jesus. We just don't have any account. Because the last written account we have about Jesus's childhood was when he was a 12-year-old boy in the temple, you know, teaching the elders and the scribes about God. And it's in the Gospel of Luke. I think it's the second chapter where Luke writes about that. And then, I mean, after that, we do not have any mention of Jesus until we pick it up again when he was about 29 years old or so, when he was baptized by John the Baptist, and he began what Christians refer to as his earthly ministry. And when I had shared this with the sadgurus and the other friends I made there, they got this big smile on their faces, and they were just nodding, and they said, well, you know, dear friend, we know exactly where Jesus was during that time. He was here in India. And I just like, what? I never heard this story before. It's like, wait a minute, you said he came to India during that time? Okay, we're talking about a 12-year-old boy. And he lived there a good 17 or so years. And they're like, yes, he was there. And he went, or I should say it's recorded, that his name was Issa, I-S-S-A, or Isha, which means Lord, Master, or Ruler. And like I said, I, you know, have never heard of this teaching before, but it struck, you know, something, it really touched my curiosity. And it's like, I got to do some research on my own about this. In other words, I needed to know, what in the world was Jesus doing in India during that time? I mean, how did he get there? How long did he stay there? And I'm just guessing 17 or so years. And was it there where Jesus grew in his stature and wisdom with all the people, as Luke says in chapter 3? Now, I will say at the beginning of this that the idea of Jesus being in India is really not well known in the Western world, let alone do many people understand it, or in fact, even many people don't even trust the accounts. It's just something that's like, well, you know, if it's not in the Bible, then you know, it didn't happen. But there's other accounts that other researchers and archaeologists and so forth who have done great extensive work in this area have been verified, and other work that they have done has also not been verified. So the school's still out, but it's interesting. And I just want to share with you a little bit about this, because according to one gentleman, Nicholas Rorick, in his book Himalaya, a monograph, said that according to the Tibetan scrolls that he found way back in 1925, Isa was 13 when he left for India. And the Nathanamandali of the Nath Yogis says that Isha reached India when he was about 14. So there is an account that yes, you know, this boy Isa was in India. And during that time, it's also been reported that the masters, you know, of course, took a liking to Jesus, and they initiated him into yoga and the highest spiritual life and prayer and meditation and, you know, living in silence. And that's when they also gave him the name Isha. As I said, it means Lord, Master, or Ruler. And the masters also had conversations with Jesus in the form of spiritual teachings, and that he should, you know, take, and as well as specific yogic practices that should also be given to his disciples one day. And it was also decided at that time that perhaps one of his disciples should be sent to India for the identical spiritual empowerment and instruction that was being handed, you know, to Jesus. And I believe it is Thomas, the one disciple / apostle who eventually went to India, and he had spent considerable time there. So for some time, it was also reported that Jesus meditated in a cave north of the present-day city of Rishikesh, which is one of the most sacred locales in India. And I had been to Rishikesh. It's a beautiful, beautiful city, a lot of ashrams. The Ganges River that flows out of the Himalayas is just beautiful. It is ice cold, trust me, it is ice cold. But I had an opportunity to bathe in the Ganges, and that was just a wonderful experience for me. Now, if Rishikesh sounds familiar, this was also the place where the Beatles spent some time working on their music, which eventually became the White Album. Okay. It didn't have any title to it. It was the White Album. And in the years that, you know, Jesus spent in this cave in the Himalayas, you know, he attained just powerful insight and realization, and really coming into who he is, that understanding. And to augment these teachings, you know, he was also sent to live in Benares. It's a city where centuries later became very familiar to Yogananda and his teacher, Sri Yukteswar. And Benares is another city on my bucket list where I'd like to go visit because it's just a spiritually integrated city, which places a lot of emphasis on just how do we live out the Spirit of God in relationships and so forth. So eventually, after his time in India, Jesus returns to what we would call Israel, and he went directly into, you know, the Jordan, where, you know, his cousin John was baptizing, John the Baptist. And there, Jesus's divinity was revealed to John and those who, as the Bible would say, you know, had the eyes to see and the ears to hear. And we have the rest of Jesus's life and teachings and death and resurrection as recorded in our Gospels. Okay. And, you know, there have been other accounts that, you know, that Jesus had once returned to India and so forth. And it was just one of those things where, you know, the Hindi people really embraced Christ, really embraced Jesus. And a contemporary written account of, you know, these findings of what was Jesus doing in India was discovered in 1887. You know, it was by a Russian traveler, Nicholas Notovich, during his wanderings in the area of Lhotka. And he had, translated from the Tibetan text, and despite intense opposition from many Christians in Russia and Europe, he published these findings in the book, The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. And as I said, not too many people in the West, will warmly receive this, but his work was often met with just severe criticism. But it was just fascinating just how the Hindi people just opened their hearts to Jesus. Now, as I said, not everybody in the West, the Western world, believes that Jesus was in India. But there was one particular Swami centuries and centuries and centuries later who was so taken by Jesus's wisdom and teaching and life that he integrated them into his own education and wisdom, not to water him down, but to expand his own knowledge and his devotion and transformed life. And the Swami I'm talking about is Paramahansa Yogananda. And it is within his book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, which, by the way, if you have never read, I highly recommend it. It's just a wonderful story that just we follow him through his, early years in India and then coming over to America and then going back to India. Just a wonderful, wonderful book. So it's within this book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, that he shares this transformation within himself as he studied the teachings of Christ and emulating how Jesus interacted with others, especially with the poor and the marginalized within society. And he goes on and tells several stories of just throughout his life and just how he was attracted to people, attracted to Christians, and how they just emulated, Christ's teachings. And he even mentions meeting other well-known Christians and mystics of his day, such as Teresa Newman. And if that name sounds familiar to you, you know that somewhere around 1923-ish, somewhere around there, it was Teresa who was a nun, but she abstained completely from food and drink except for her daily taking of, the Eucharist or this small consecrated wafer to celebrate Jesus's suffering, death, and resurrection. But the stigmata, which is what she's really known for, or the sacred wounds of Christ, appeared on her in 1926, about 3 years later. And she had wounds on her head, on her chest, her hands, and her feet, her eyes. And it's told that on Friday of every week after that, she would pass through the Passion of Christ, suffering in her own body all these agonies, all these pains, all these marks, all everything that went with Jesus' own suffering. And everything that led up to his crucifixion and then some. So, Yogananda also had written other books, which I recommend for anyone who would like to read. And one of the books that I'm currently involved in, working my way through, it's a two-volume set, so you got to take your time with it. But it's The Second Coming of Christ, and just how do we live out the resurrection, not only in ourselves, but also within the greater context of our relationships. Well, I would really like to hear your heart on this subject, and if you've heard this story before, and just what are some of your thoughts. So if you would like to call in, I invite you to do that, and the number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Well, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share with you a word about next week's show, February the 19th. You know, the year is just flying by here. Okay. That broadcast is going to be entitled The War Against the Weak and the Wounded. And, you know, just how often do the weak and wounded are treated in society? From people who are considered outcasts or untouchable, unlovable, and therefore they are unreachable in the eyes of society. Some in society. I can't make generalizations, sweeping generalizations against that. But we certainly see enough, just how people who are already close to falling through the cracks through perhaps no fault of their own. But they're wounded in some way, and just how society would treat them, or how society says one thing but does something else. And a lot of times, we get this impression that, well, the only way to deal with somebody wounded is if you deal with them as a wounded horse. You just want to shoot them. But why do we feel it necessary to shoot our wounded? Where do we get that from? I mean, what purpose does that serve? So that's something we're going to take a look at next week. And it certainly ties into with what we're going to be talking about, coming up here, and just how Jesus reached out to the weak and the wounded. A lot of times when we think about people who are weakened or wounded or something of that nature, we wait for them to make the first move. And certainly, I've heard this said many a times, like, well, we have plenty of resources, they just need to access them. And it's like, yeah, I understand that, I get that, but how many times, going back to relationships, it takes somebody else to reach out to them and to establish a relationship with them. And through that relationship, empowering them to reach out for these services, or empowering them to live better, or whatever the case might be. So again, it comes back clearly in terms of relationships and, how well we treat others and so forth is often how we treat ourselves. And, by that I mean that if we have contempt for others, there's going to be somewhere deep down inside of us that we're a little bit contemptuous with ourself, for some reason, or we're short-tempered, or some sort of, inflexibility within us, or not being tolerable of something inside of us, and that often gets projected out onto others. So again, next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time, February 19th, we're going to take a look at the war against the weak and the wounded. Well, as we're going to be entering into the season of Lent this coming Wednesday, Wednesday the 17th, I thought it would be appropriate to share with you Yogananda's writings on Jesus and how he was greatly influenced, namely what Jesus did in his life that was exemplified in the relationships he had and still has with all people. And one of the things that really struck Yogananda, really caught his attention and really became transformative to him, is when he discovered what he referred to as the most significant aspect of Jesus's teaching. That was about living without prejudice and without seeing who is yours and who is not yours. And only then, he said, one would know the kingdom of God. And it's kind of like a dying to self, putting that ego to rest, as the Apostle Paul had written in one of his own letters, that he dies daily so that it's not I that live, but it is Christ who lives in and through me. And to further illustrate this point, Yogananda also really made it clear that, again, what he really liked is Jesus' teaching on that the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God is within you. And of course, that just lined up beautifully with his meditative practices. And so he was always just going inward and sitting in that silence and just very powerful meditation on the truths of God. And, you know, just what is to be discovered, I should say, when he sits quietly and listens for God's voice. Now, to further illustrate this point regarding the kingdom of God, you know, the Apostle Paul also wrote elsewhere in the book of Colossians, you know, to whom God was pleased to make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. So, as I said, Yogananda was greatly transformed by these teachings and looked for many ways in which people could look within themselves and follow Jesus's way of life. And as I said, how he interacted with everybody and the special attention he gave to the marginalized or the poor or the vulnerable and the weak. And elsewhere he writes that if you allow the Spirit of Christ to transform you, everything will be brought into harmony. So, you know, and that is the very basis of Jesus's teachings. And so his words brought much sacrifice and piety and love to the world. But again, Yogananda just saw the most important aspect of Jesus's life and his teaching was that the kingdom of God is within you. And out of that, you know, that transformation, you know, certainly it's going to show up in your relationships and how you treat others, how you see others, and so forth. And it's also found within Matthew's gospel. You know, Matthew can certainly bring out this in terms of it being, you know, in the parables that Jesus taught about the kingdom of God. And here's just a couple of examples. In the 13th chapter of Matthew's Gospels, where we have many of these parables or these stories, and you know, this is Jesus talking, where he says the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found, but then he hid it again, and from joy he goes and he sells all that he has and he buys that field. And elsewhere, it's like the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding that one pearl of great value, he went and sold all he had, and he bought it. And then elsewhere, and this happens to be one of my favorites, is that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, you know, which a man took and sowed in his field. And this is smaller than all other seeds, but when it's full grown, it's larger than garden plants, and it becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. Okay, and then lastly, you know, he also spoke another parable to them that the kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in three measures of flour until it was all leavened. And so we can certainly say, you know, that understanding, you know, spiritual principles and, you know, the kingdom of God is within you is very much a spiritual process. And it's not exclusive to any group or any cult or a fan club. It's this individual seeking with great earnesty that you will find it if you are seeking with that pure heart, just like Jesus said in these parables that, you know, these people were just looking, and then once they found it, whether it be the pearls or something else, you know, they just went and sold everything, and this is what I really want. You know, this is, you know, everything else is fine and okay, but when I find the kingdom of heaven, when I'm going within and I find the very voice of God, it's as if, you know, our hearts have been looking for something that we found. Okay. And as I said, this was very transformative to Yogananda, and he shared this all the time. In fact, there were many times when Yogananda, when he eventually came over here to America back in the day, he had started first in New York City. And some of his teachings were well received, some of it was not, but then he decides to go out to California. And this is where the Self-Realization Fellowship was established. And so great following out there. And you can see their beliefs and so forth on their website, www.yogananda-srf for selfrealizationfellowship.org. Okay. And you can just also read more of Yogananda's teachings and so forth. But Yogananda loved to celebrate Jesus's birth. He loved to celebrate Jesus's resurrection. And there were times in which he would lead, like, say, an Easter service or a Christmas Eve service or a Christmas Day service, and spoke of just what it means for us to be an Easter people, and to, like, how do you live out this resurrection? Like, what? How do we put that into practice? And of course, how he shared these truths was, you know, we put it into practice, of course, in relationships. But coming back to the weak and the wounded, which we're going to take a look at next week, this is how it's lived out. You know, it's always, how can I serve? How can I reach out to somebody to make their life better? Because, again, when we think about it, we come into the world with everything that we need, okay? Those gifts and graces and skills and talents and resiliency and all that stuff, that's fine. But we get to a point where we realize, after we discover all there is to us, that those gifts and talents and strengths and personality and resiliency and so forth are not meant for us. They, you know, are in us, things to be discovered, the very best of ourselves, but they're not meant for us. They're meant to be shared. They're meant to be given away. They're meant to, you know, pass on for somebody else for the betterment of an individual or a group of people or a society. Because you never know when you could be an answer to somebody's prayer. You know, you never know. You just happen to be in the right place at the right time, and you just show up. And that's all God wants you to do, is just show up. And because of that presence, and because of how the Spirit of God has been working in your life, it seems effortless. Or it's like, I don't even know what I was doing, because I just befriended this person. And like, well, that's all it takes sometimes. You know, there's an old saying that I kind of grew up hearing from time to time. And it was, you know, sometimes we're going to be the only Bible that somebody reads. And I know we live in an age right now, a day in an age where, you know, certain aspects of Christianity are not well received, or the church and so forth, or biblical teachings not well received and or met with a lot of skepticism. But one of the things that cannot be denied is how people are treated. You know, and just when you are living out that transformation in you and through you, and that's what captures people's attention, even if they don't know what to call it, even if they have no idea. It's just, something is different. Something is challenging me. Something is stirring my heart. Something is causing me to shake and shiver, if you want to call it that. Something is reminding me that God has always been with me, that God always sees me, and how they can live in hope through the kindness of others or the hope of others and so forth. So, as I said, Yogananda just loved teaching on not only the birth of Jesus and Jesus's teachings in general, but also celebrating the resurrection, because it was just, how do we take the resurrection of this Christed energy now, this resurrected Christed energy, how do we live that out? How do we put that into practice? Well, as I typically tell anybody who's interested in transformation, it's like, okay, first of all, I need you to take, you know, reach over your shoulder and pull down this proverbial seatbelt and make sure it's locked into place and hang on. Because when we are open and inviting the Spirit of God to come in, or the Spirit of God to, you know, move upon us or move in us or move with us, we are in for one heck of a ride. 'Cause that's just, you know, as much as we can understand, we ain't seen nothing yet when it comes to transformation. You know, we really, really haven't. You know, and it would, you know, I hear this from many people that, you know, I wish God would just hurry up and show me everything instead of just incremental stuff, you know, this incremental learning. And I just have to say, yeah, that's nice, but I don't think we could handle it. You know, seeing everything all at once, it is such a powerful energy that we would all probably just fall over. We would die because it would just be too much for us. But incrementally, you know, God reveals things in our lives when we are ready, when we are open, when we are in that teachable frame of mind and being teachable in our hearts and in our spirits. And when we are ready for it, then little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And we also need that time for integration, because it's one thing just to say, oh, okay, this great thing has happened. Now let's just run with it. And we don't give it time to fully integrate or to take root in us and to kind of, you know, flesh out. And what does this mean? And really struggle within ourselves as to, okay, what is getting in the way of this. And I think I share with you a couple of times in these broadcasts that I switched my whole prayer life from, you know, God, give me this, God, give me that, to God, remove this, remove that from me. Because, you know, I want to know, you know, the fullness of who I am, that vast self, as well as I want the fullness of the Spirit of Christ in me, and to fully embrace that, fully understand it, fully see it, fully walk in it. But what's getting in the way of that? What keeps tripping me up? What keeps holding me back? You know, where's my mind coming in and actually talking myself out of it, so to speak? Because we do that. We're very good at talking ourselves in and out of things all the time, all the time. But just what are those things that get in the way that God needs to move, or I need to let go of, or I need to forgive, I need to release, I need to work through, and so forth. And you'll grow tired of me saying this, but it always brings us back to the relationships in our lives, that we have to start there. You know, because as I said, we often experience our greatest and deepest wounds in relationships with others. But in order to find healing, we go back into relationships, and hopefully through healthier relationships, that's where we find our greatest healing from either a damage or woundedness that we had endured or experienced. Okay. Well, as I said, I just want to share with you a couple of writings from Yogananda regarding Jesus, and just he loved Christ. And I'm just going to read little sections here from his one book. It's a two-volume set. It's The Second Coming of Christ, The Resurrection of Christ Within You. Okay, and one of the sections, he says, resurrection has been well understood by accomplished yogis of India since the dawn of the highest ages. And Jesus himself was a yogi, one who knew and mastered the spiritual science, as he puts it, of life and death, or communion with God or union with God, and one who knew and loved the kingdom of God. And Jesus showed throughout his life and death his power of complete mastery over his body and his mind. Okay, so like I said, this fits in nicely with a Hindi understanding. And he says that we understand resurrection in its true sense when we understand these underlying principles by which Jesus resurrected his crucified body and into the freedom and light of God. So resurrection does not only mean resurrection of the body, but the ascension of the soul in order to live immortally in oneness with the Spirit of God that is manifested throughout the whole universe. Okay. And Yogananda also goes on to say that Jesus's resurrection was not quite understood at the beginning. And, you know, and we do have that recorded in Mark's gospel that, you know, when Jesus ascended into heaven, the disciples didn't know what to do with it. They just stood there looking up, and then they just went home. And that's all we get from Mark's gospel. You know, there was just much of what in the world just happened here. You know, now what do we do kind of thing? And this was all before Pentecost, and which the Spirit of God was given to humanity in a way in which they've never seen before. Okay, so at the time, you know, Yogananda said that Jesus' resurrection was little understood, and there was some disbelief, even though Jesus also elsewhere recorded made himself visible to hundreds of people, not just to his close disciples. And, you know, in those days, they comprehended only that Jesus was dead and then he was alive. But perhaps they didn't quite understand, you know, shall we say, the nuances of Jesus' resurrection and ascension. And what now do we do with that? Because one of the things that I think is quite fascinating, and I read this every year on Easter, that, you know, after, you know, the resurrection, Jesus appears to his disciples. It's just kind of interesting. You know, he appeared to them, and we have the account that, yes, Peter was there, the one who betrayed him, but Peter didn't say anything. And then Jesus goes on and, you know, reveals himself to others, and the disciples went back to fishing. And, of course, Peter was a fisherman. And so it's kind of strange that they fully didn't grasp the resurrection yet and what that meant, because they just like, okay, well, whatever, we'll go back to doing what we know. And, you know, and that's where, you know, the end of John's gospel is so important, because Jesus has this conversation, you know, shall we say, over breakfast. Sunrise, and Jesus has a little hibachi there with, you know, some coals on it burning, and Peter's out there, and, you know, didn't catch anything, you know, this great fisherman, but he didn't catch anything. And Jesus is like, you know, hey, did you catch anything? And, you know, and everybody's like, no, I didn't catch anything. And Jesus says, well, how about you throw the net on the other side of the boat? And that's when it's starting to click with Peter. And then as soon as they did, they pulled up all these fish that the nets were starting to break. And then that's when, I think it was John, the youngest disciple, said, it's the Lord, it's Jesus standing there. And that's all Peter needed to hear. And he just, you know, hightailed it through the water and met up with Jesus. And they have this wonderful conversation of, you know, Peter, you used to be a fisherman, but I'm not calling you to be a fisherman anymore. I want you to be a shepherd. And now it's time to take care of the sheep who are wounded, who are weak, who need leadership, and so forth. Because when you think about it, especially lambs or just sheep in general, they are, well, they're not only stupid, but they're also very vulnerable. If you've ever seen, a sheepdog trying to herd them and so forth. But sheep are just very vulnerable and susceptible to all kinds of injury and danger. And Jesus is saying, Peter, this is what I'm calling you into. Please see the wounded for who they are. But there's so much more to them. And just really, you know, in that conversation was transforming enough for Peter that he finally got it. He finally understood what it means to walk in the light of the resurrection. And so, as I said, this is something that Yogananda just latched onto, and he certainly integrated it into his own practices, his own Hindi background, his own culture, and, you know, it was very transformative in his life and the lives of others. So let me just read one more section here, and let's see, there's many to choose from. Let's see. Yes, here's a good one. Certainly Jesus was born in a human body. He was crucified, and he was resurrected. And though he appeared in physical form to his disciples many times after the crucifixion, he would still disappear from time to time. Okay. And so, in oneness with the infinite Christ, he is resurrected in every newborn body, in you and in me and in all the people of the earth and in everything that has life. He is resurrected in the winking stars and in the planets and in the cosmos. He is resurrected in all things that grow from the earth, from the grass to the tenderest rose. He feels his resurrection in every form that exists. He is risen in every atom and cell of the capacious cosmos. Okay. So, you know, certainly it is quite interesting to understand not only that Jesus was in India and how he got there and what actually did he do and did he return again and all that stuff. That, okay, that's fine. But, you know, some people don't believe that. That's okay. That's fine, too. But it still doesn't excuse the fact of, well, then how, you know, how we should understand his teachings and how they impact us. And the whole point was that one who came from India was highly, highly touched. So a final note, I'll leave you with these words from Yogananda. He writes, Easter may bring lilies, bunnies, and eggs for you to celebrate Christ's resurrection. But I pray that the lily of Christ's wisdom grow in the garden of your soul, that you taste the sweetness of Christ's love in your heart, that you enjoy the infinitely colored egg of true happiness, and that, like the fast-footed bunny, may you quicken your pace towards your divine home. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Until then, please be safe, please behave yourself, and go with God's peace. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.